Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with security shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Today's sponsor is Audible. With an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio news, comedy, and more, get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial at audible.com/decode. Today's show is also brought to you by Videoblocks. Videoblocks is a subscription-based stock media company that gives you unlimited access to premium stock footage everyone can afford. You get unlimited daily downloads from a library of 115,000 HD video clips, After Effects templates, motion backgrounds, and cinemagraphs. On average, subscribers pay less than $1 per download over the course of a year. Everything is 100% royalty-free, even if you get your subscription canceled. Keep what you download and maintain usage rights forever. Get a yearly subscription today for only $99 at videoblocks.com/recode. Hi, I'm Kara Swisher, executive editor of Recode.
And I'm Lauren Good, senior editor of technology at The Verge.
And this is Too Embarrassed to Ask, a podcast that's all about making technology easier to understand and use.
If you have questions about tech that you've been too embarrassed to ask, you have found the right podcast. No question is a bad question, so send us yours.
Submit your questions in advance by tweeting to @Recode or myself or Lauren with the hashtag Too Embarrassed. That's two R's and two S's in embarrassed in case you cannot spell.
Aw, thank you so much, Kara. I love when you spell for me.
I'm simply also referring to you on that.
Oh, yeah, I'm the one that's more likely to mess it up, I suppose. But you can also email us because we've caught up with the times and we have an email address now. No, actually, some of our listeners were writing in our reviews on iTunes and saying, we have questions and how can we send them to you and not have to tweet them. And so we have an email. It's tooembarrassed2rs2s@recode.net.
Do we have a carrier pigeon next? Is that our next move?
Yeah, carrier pigeon, but it's an Uber that just
carries the letters around. A Didi, really, is what it is. You can find all of our past episodes on iTunes at itunes.com/tooembarrassedask. And while you're there, leave us a review.
So, Kara, we were in the same city last week. I was so happy to be taping our podcast in the same city as you. We just had I had a great time. I don't know about you.
No, I couldn't get far enough
away from you.
It was
as good for you as it was
for
me.
I could not get far enough away from you. I'm in New York this week. I'll be in Australia next week. And then I'm going to Borneo. I'm going to be coming to you from Borneo.
So when are you actually back in studio? You're probably back here when I'm in New York.
Mid-August.
You've planned it
quite well. I'm not giving you my schedule. It's very secret.
Yeah.
I'm a very glamorous person. Yeah.
We're going to tell you how secret it is when we talk about hacking later
on in this episode.
Go.
All right. Okay.
Pretty sure the Russians have access to your schedule.
We're going
to
bring in an expert, correct?
Yes. Yes. We have brought in Russell Brandom from The Verge. He is my esteemed colleague over The Verge, and he covers all things cybersecurity. Russell, thank you for joining
us. Yes, he's sitting right across from me, and he's giving me the creeps with all this hacking situation. I wrote a lot about hacking this weekend. I'm very excited to talk about
that. Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
You did about voting.
I mean, there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Russell, tell us what the latest is. And we're talking about this because late last week, after the DNC, I think it was after the DNC had concluded, news reports started to leak out that it was believed that Russian intelligence services had hacked the DNC. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, it's Putin, essentially. And then they also possibly hacked the Clinton campaign computer systems and possibly others.
And also the Democratic Congressional
Campaign Committee.
I knew there was an extra C in there.
Yeah, DCCCCCC.
So this is one of the weird things. My like pet thing is I don't really... The word hacking, well, it's catchy. It's like a little weird because it lumps all this stuff together. So, I mean, the thing with the DNC was they got this huge email archive and they sort of somehow it found its way to WikiLeaks.
Somehow.
And it was really embarrassing. Like, this is not something that's going to be worth a lot of money if you're a criminal hacker. Mm-hmm. But it certainly was really embarrassing. Debbie Wasserman Schultz ended up resigning as chair of the
This is the representative
DNC.
Who is chairman.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was clearly very damaging to her and sort of damaging to, you know, this was not the impression that they wanted to be starting a convention with.
And she resigned because her emails were showing a bias towards the Clinton campaign and against Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, and there was a lot of sort of, you know, after you get off the phone with someone you don't like and you kind of are like, I cannot believe this horrible person. There's
yeah, like
just
every
a lot
time Kara wraps a podcast taping with me and she fires up that loud. Message I don't about care. How much...
my emails reflect, my tweets reflect what I'm saying right now.
Yes, I'm sorry, Russell.
So, yeah, I mean, so then the DCCC hack was a little weird because it seems like it was... intercepting information that people were sending to the DCCC. Yeah. So it wasn't actually...
financial information.
Yeah, financial information, which is obviously bad news for the donors. But it also doesn't necessarily mean that the actual DCCC website was compromised or any of the information that they had themselves was compromised. So it wasn't that their big list of names and credit card numbers came out. It was that some of the, they thought they were sending it to the good guys and they were really sending it to the bad guys. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, the Clinton campaign, so, you know, there had been rumors that they may have been targeted for a while. There was, I think, a New York Times report a few months ago. And then we got kind of late Friday, this admittedly good scoop, like they weren't just attempts, someone got in, mm-hmm. but then it's kind of not clear what they got. Like if you read the article, all they said was, it was hacked.
An analysis part of the program. They're being very...
Yeah. Well, and so this is the thing. So then the Clinton campaign says, oh, no, it was just our voter targeting information, which is like, well, you know, Rust Belt voters care about the economy. And we should talk about the economy. And like, you know, if we know this about a person, what messaging do we want? Which, I mean, I'm sure they spent a lot of money on, but is not super sensitive or, you know, it's not politically sensitive. It doesn't... You're not going to gain anything by releasing that. But also, I mean, the Clinton campaign, it's in their interest to... minimize it. So sure. I don't know that it, we can yeah. entirely take them at their word, but it is one of these things where it's just...
Well, you're not going to say. I mean, yeah. just like Sony, you're going to be very quiet about what was taken, how was it taken, and everything
yeah,
else
exactly.
so you don't set off a chain reaction.
Yeah. So it's one of these things where they're all hacks, but when you lay it out like that, it's not clear if all of these people wanted
Let's
the same thing.
Let's just say
thing.
It's not good.
It's no, it's certainly
Russell,
not good.
This
None
is not
of these
good,
things.
It's a breach
and it's
of some
Putin.
Sort.
Like, and it's Putin.
Well, so this is because you're going to get me in trouble now. Because Why? All my, I mean, it is just like Sony in right. that Putin is sort of, you know,
I'm just using that as a broad
well,
Russian
yeah.
thing.
No, but I mean, this is, it's very dicey anytime one of these things comes up because attribution, who did it, mm-hmm. is the first question.
Well, I believe most of the reporting says that the Russian intelligence services of which he ran once. So, I mean, yeah. this is essentially an attack from Russia,
yeah.
apparently. And then there's a question of how the our administration should respond, our government should respond to it.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I think the weird thing about it, though, and I think the reason there's a lot of, among security writers, everyone's very, very nervous, basically about ever saying anything. I mean, God, Vice just did a whole documentary about how Sony wasn't North Korea and everything's fine. But I think, you know, the really sort of proof evidence you never really see. It's never really public. And also the only people who get it are private security companies and the government. And we don't really trust either of those people. So you very easily end up in this place where it's like, well, there have been, you know, indications, but who really knows and yada, yada.
Yeah. But still, is it part of a larger wave of cybersecurity hacks? It just is. It's like it seems yeah, like every yeah. day there's something and whatever nefarious reason or whatever political reason or financial reason, it's just increased. Or maybe we just know about it.
Well, I think there is this sense of, you know, it's the IT revolution to, mm-hmm. to be. That's a couple revolutions ago now. But I mean, as more of these things come online, it's harder and harder to make sure everything is locked down. And so right. you just, and no one really knows what the best practices are. And there's mm-hmm. no easy answer to it of like, let's just buy everyone an iPhone and everything will be taken care of. Like mm-hmm. there isn't a simple fix for it.
What kind of hack was this exactly? This recent hack? These recent
Which
hack?
One? The
all the DNC hack.
The DNC hack seems to have been spear phishing. So they sent someone an email with some attachment and they opened the attachment.
Which is common. And, easy.
And then, yeah, no, I mean, yeah, it's generally how these things came in. It doesn't seem like they had a new vulnerability to it, but it was just that it was sort of downloaded through this email system. And then once some user of it clicked yes to the attachment, then from there, it sort of spread until they had everything on the email system.
Mm-hmm. Russell, when we were chatting earlier about this, we were basically saying how it feels like everything is vulnerable these days, right? And so most of the security solutions that we're seeing is just there are vulnerabilities and some people are keeping on top of them and patching them as needed. And in other cases, the patching is not being done. And so it's just a race to who can expose or patch these vulnerabilities first. And it seems like it's almost inevitable.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was going to say in this case, there wasn't like a 0-day vulnerability, which is one where no one even knew that it was out there. Mm-hmm. We've known about it for 0 days. But generally, you don't really need one of those. I mean, it's something like 99% of intrusions that happen. It's sort of a known vulnerability that you just either no one had written up a patch, which does happen. I mean, it's like 6 months between mm-hmm. when these are disclosed and when people get around to fixing them. Or it had been patched, but the patch just hadn't made it out. I mean, I think the thing with the DNC, and this is a little tricky because I'm going to get in a little bit of trouble in terms of like free software, but probably the worst, you know, if you were to pin it down to a single choice that they made, they were running their own email server, not in like a Hillary way, although sort of like that, but in a sort of, you know, it was just we don't know exactly the software they used, but it
probably
was
wasn't the
similar
finest
to grade. Like Exchange.
It was not weapons grade.
A sort of Microsoft
serverness.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, the main thing is it wasn't just an instance of Gmail, for instance, where you would have, if someone attacks your instance of Gmail, it's sitting on the same cloud server with all the other instances of Gmail, and they have some person who's looking at all of them. And if weird stuff starts happening, then
they can shut
he or she jumps in. And
so what is the most common form of hacking these days? What is the...
I mean, I think I would say generally, if you talk to the penetration testers, which is someone you hire to mm-hmm. hack your own company.
Sounds dirty.
They say the simplest thing is always spear phishing, where mm-hmm. you research some... It's spear phishing because it's specific. So you say, okay, who are Russell's friends? You know, what's the name of Russell's landlord? And then I'm going to figure out, I'm going to dummy up an email that looks like it's from Russell's landlord. It's going to have this attachment. And then I'm going to say, you know, oh my gosh, like, we need you to sign this document. Are you going to be evicted tomorrow? And then that's a pretty good way for me to open an attachment. And mm-hmm. so then I open it and that's it. Mm-hmm. That's generally how they get in. And mm-hmm. then it's just a matter of, you know, there are, you know, you've got mice in your house. How do you get the mice out of the house? And mm-hmm. it's just sort of a network game. Well, really.
What are some other examples of that? Like, was the Target hack from a couple years ago the result of spear phishing?
So that one's interesting because what they were... So the whole cycle of payment process... Or they weren't really payment processors, but point of sale hacks. So this was Target, Home Depot, PF Chang's was in there, I think. And it was sort of different versions of the same software that would just hit place after place after place. And I mean, you know, now we have a whole different, you know, permanently changed the balance of power between like stores and credit card companies. But so they were trying to get onto this point of sale terminal, which is the tiny computer that you put your credit card into, which is harder to get into because it's sort of, it doesn't like go on the internet. You're not opening your email up on them. So that they went in, they compromised, I think in Target specifically, they compromised the company that was providing air conditioning services to Target, like corporate. Mm-hmm. And then they compromised them and then included somehow from there, they were able to jump
over to
the Target
network. So
there's
almost no way to keep people out that it feels like that.
Well, I mean, yes. Yeah, so there is the change in perspective in the last few years has been it's not about building a high wall. It's about finding out as soon as they're in. Mm-hmm. So you sort of have awareness of when they get in mm-hmm. and then being really good at getting them out mm-hmm. as opposed mm-hmm. to just saying we're never, you know, our plan is no one ever gets in. So it's sort of, you know, instead of just having a big wall and then people just chip at it until eventually they get through the wall, you're kind of keeping an eye on it and then you see everything that comes in. And so you just have a very good awareness of what's happening instead of really hardening it. So and counting on nothing ever getting in.
So there's spear phishing attacks. There's attacks on financial services or point of sale systems, we should say, in this case. There's obviously, like, you know, Stuxnet, which was a 0-day event.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Which is that's categorized differently from the other things we're talking about. What other kinds of hacks?
It's a little bit of a... The word kind of means everything. I mean, the way I think about it is the motivation, and sometimes that can be a little fuzzy too, but fundamentally people are interested in, you know, most of the time it's just people looking for money And so they want anything that they can. They want your credit card number, or they want your social security number, or they want like a large database that they can sell for money. And then this sort of gets passed around. And that's sort of most of it. And most of those people aren't very good.
It's like petty thievery.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And that, I mean, but that's also the thing that you probably have to worry about the most. Mm-hmm. Like if it's just in terms of like, who took over my mom's Facebook account? It was just some random criminal, so he could ask people to wire him money. Like that's
but in a more serious way, we talk about that and everyone's sort of the way things are going to be as people are online. But I had written a story this week on Schreier's blog. He talked about voting machines, which has been a debate for years about the vulnerability of voting machines. It was even a plot point on Scandal. The president won his job from a voting machine.
And if it was on ABC, primetime.
True, but he was talking about the serious vulnerabilities of voting booths, and that the Russians could target these voting machines, even though, and suggested a number of things like a paper trail and no internet voting whatsoever. Like he was sort of underscoring that idea, which is coming, I think, internet voting.
It's tricky. I mean, I think the big thing is the you would have to change politically what voting means. Because, I mean, the main reason we have non-remote voting is just old school, like Tammany Hall era voter fraud, where like, you know, Bankoff calls us all into a room and he's like, guys, I'm really excited about all of you voting for, you know, Jill Stein.
Right.
And then he watches us fill out the ballots. Right. Or I mean, the union boss or whatever. Right. And this is kind of the classic model of voter fraud. And this is why they say, OK, no, we have to make sure it's just you heading into the booth and no one else sees it. And you can only fill out one ballot and do that thing.
Right.
But I mean, I think, you know, otherwise, yeah, like it's a real concern. I think it's the people I would be worried about hacking voting machines would be the people with direct access to the voting machines. And I think it's tricky. I feel like this is a scenario in which we should be able to make sure that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know that I have that much faith in our government. And I think also one of the lessons of the DNC hack, I would say, is we do have these organizations that are vital to our democracy, whether or not you like them. Like, we need to be able to have these political organizations that have the capacity to communicate privately, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're not very well funded, and they're all sort of shoestring operations.
As are many voting.
Yeah, exactly. As are the voting operations. And I mean, this is part of the thing, right? It's not, you're not hacking Bank of America, where someone has spent a lot of money to make sure that no one can get into that, and then also spent a lot of money.
Are you worried about voting machines, though? Are you worried about?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I'm worried about voting machines just not working.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I'm also, I think, I mean, I don't know that it's extremely likely, but the result of it would be so catastrophic to just sort of the body politic of, that election, do we think it was fake? We're going to go back and forth on whether it was fake based on this information. I mean, just the conversation over each time we have the DNC or Sony, there's this back and forth over attribution because it's so high stakes, even though we never really do anything about it.
Well, that you know of.
Well, I mean, let's just say worst case scenario, there was a hack on our voting system for this presidential campaign. I mean, there would have to be some type of recourse, I would think, if that was exposed after the fact. If we all went out in November and voted, and then it was, you know, 3 days later, like, there's been a major hack on the voting system. Like, I just don't see how we could rest on the results.
But, well, I think that's the trickiest thing where, I mean, I don't know that you would actually get to a point where
you could attribute it to,
well, or you could say definitively, you know what, we know that this was electronically tampered with. And that's sort of what's.
And then it would enter the political spectrum.
Yeah, well, I mean, and then, yeah, I mean, so are we all just going to go back the week after that and say, okay, guys, like, new election, mulligan, and certainly whoever won the election isn't going to be thrilled about
Lauren,
that.
Lauren, you're forgetting the Chads. That went on for some while.
Well, no, exactly.
Who knows who won that election?
I just like that you use the term mulligan because Kara doesn't really like sports balls.
I know what a mulligan is. All right, I'm going to do a little
Let's take a break for some money making.
Money making right there. In a minute, we're going to answer some questions from our readers and listeners. But first, today's show is sponsored by Qualcomm. They were the company that first connected our phones to the internet, making our phones smart. And now they're connecting the internet to everything else. Most people don't know this, but Qualcomm creates the technologies we use every day, whether it's powering experiences in our smartphones, Wi-Fi in our routers, sensors in our cars, or virtual reality. Qualcomm is leading the way to a fully connected world. Technology is at a pivotal juncture. Billions of devices are becoming connected, affecting not only how we communicate with each other, but also how entire industries are shaped. From healthcare to automobiles to smart homes to smart cities, Qualcomm is leading the wave of innovation that will significantly improve how we live. They're accelerating the seamless connectivity, as well as intelligence, of billions of other devices and leading the world to 5G. This episode is also brought to you by VideoBlocks, a subscription-based stock media company that gives you unlimited access to premium stock footage everyone can afford. You get unlimited daily downloads from a library of 115,000 HD video clips, After Effects templates, motion backgrounds, and cinemagraphs. On average, subscribers pay less than $1 a download over the course of a year. This is the same content you'd find on more expensive stock sites at cheaper prices. There's a great variety of time-lapse, aerials, U.S. and international locations, slow motion, nature shots, and more. They're continuously adding new content to the library so it stays fresh. Subscribers receive membership-only access to the marketplace for even more clips from the global contributor community. Everything is 100% royalty-free, even if a subscription is canceled. You get unrestricted usage rights for personal or commercial projects. Keep what you download and maintain usage rights forever. VideoBlocks is offering Too Embarrassed to Ask listeners a year's subscription for $99. This is $50 off the usual price tag. That's less than $10 a month. Get your yearly subscription today for only $99 at videoblocks.com/ask. That's VideoBlocks, which is VideoBlocks.com/ask for this exclusive offer. All right, every week we ask our readers and listeners to send in their questions, comments, and complaints about tech topics. You can do that by tweeting with us at #TooEmbarrassed or emailing us TooEmbarrassed@recode.net. This week we asked our listeners for their questions about hacking. Lauren, do you want to read the first question?
Sure. And we should say, too, that some of these questions were all over the place in a good way. Some are broader questions about hacking. Some are more about personal protection for your own accounts and information and that sort of thing. So they run the gamut. But the first one is from Sunny John. That's at Sunny_John on Twitter. And he asks, where do most of the hacks in the U.S. originate from and what entities are targeted the most? This is a tough one.
Russell,
yeah. Do you have any insights
into
that?
So, I mean, this is the tricky thing. We were talking about attribution. We kind of don't know. I would say in terms of foreign, like, attacks that don't originate in the U.S., there's just, you know, Russia and Eastern Europe tend to be very, very active, right? And also you see this if you ever, credit card companies are extremely aware of sort of sudden surreptitious charges from Russia or Ukraine or sort of that region. Actually, if you're traveling, you can call your credit card company and say, oh, I'm going to be, you know, in Moscow next week. Like, just so you know, like, make sure the charges go through. Mm-hmm. And one of my friends was going to Russia and sort of called her company and they said, oh, don't bother. Just bring cash. We're not going to, you can call us and tell us, but it won't matter. We won't honor it no matter what, because, well, I mean, and just sort of having built up all this thing of being in the U.S., it was,
right.
You know, if you're, there are a couple of hotspots where they just don't do
There's
it.
There's also flavors of hacking. Yeah. So the Russians hack credit cards, the Chinese hack this. I was with the Mandiant CEO, and he was going on and saying which countries like to focus on financial services and others. And he didn't mention U.S. hackers at all. And I said, what about U.S. hackers? He's like, oh, they're terrible. Like, he was like, they're just
terrible,
not even
like,
in
not
the same
good
class.
At it or but terrible.
He's like, no, terrible at hacking compared to the worldwide group of hackers.
Well, there's also
we should
really
be good at hacking.
There's a bit of a gentleman's agreement where U.S. companies don't the reports. So we get, you know, we've got their companies all over doing reports on all sorts of, you know, state based hacking. But, you know, Kaspersky Lab, which is based in Russia, tends to focus on U.S. and European and Chinese state hacking, and sort of the U.S. firms focus on Russian and Chinese hacking.
Well, he was saying the U.S. hackers are as good as the ones.
No, I'm sure. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, which was really funny. All right, the next question is from Jonathan Bernstein at DF Campfin. Is it worthwhile to have a unique random password for each of our website logins?
Yes. Definitely. Yes. So, I mean, the thing that you will see.
You mean
is,
1, 2, 3, 4 is not.
No. I love Hopefully Lauren Good not. Is not good, Kara, so change
well,
it.
Well, that's all of them, everybody.
So, I mean.
None of them. By is, which I mean, none of them.
So, for most passwords, it's a web service. So, it's not just, you know, if the hacker is alone in a dark room with your computer and it's not checking onto anything, then they can potentially just cycle through a lot of passwords, in mm-hmm. which case it is good to have the random one, although in the long term you're kind of screwed anyway because they're just going to eventually guess it. But you know, most things, you know, if it's Gmail, you're not just going to run through 1,000 passwords before, you know, Google will notice that you're guessing more than a password mm-hmm. a second and say, I think something suspicious right. is going on here. So, but the case in which it does matter is a lot of times you'll get a situation. And this is true for data breaches in general, where a company loses control of a password database, but it's still encrypted. But if they know some passwords that are likely to be in the list, then they get an unencrypted version of the whole thing. And so having a lot of them be random things that are hard to guess makes that process a lot harder. Mm-hmm. And then also we get a lot of, you know, in terms of having different passwords for the same service, once they do get it unencrypted, they'll say, you know, maybe they have everyone's LinkedIn password, which is not just a hypothetical example. That did happen. Mm-hmm. Then the first thing they do, you know, they're not really going to get anything from your LinkedIn account. So they'll try it through, try it in your banking account. They'll try it in your mm-hmm. email account.
They have different passwords for every single thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, and that's the important thing. Because then if one of them gets breached, you don't have to say, oh, wait, right. was I using that one for all of these others? So, and there are a lot of good services. 1Password is one that
well, that's the next
locally.
Question.
Yeah, the next question is from Bobby Perotti. He's at Rutzo on Twitter. Maybe our goal is tech literate people should be just to educate on 1Password first, get people to stop reusing passwords. So in short, what you're saying, Russell, is if you have a long, complicated password, you know, randomly generated with a lot of different characters, then you're less vulnerable to brute force, which is this idea of someone just like, you know, it's a hacker cycling through several potential passwords in seconds and trying to figure out what your password is. And then, worst case scenario, they do get past 1 entry point. They're not able to use that same password and cross-reference it across multiple accounts and get access to, let's say, your financial
services,
right?
So what do you think of 1Password?
So I love 1Password personally.
I do, too.
Like, I use it, and I like that it does device-to-device syncing over Wi-Fi rather than storing things in the cloud. I find it really easy to use. I mean, it's not like a learning curve. It's just, it takes some time to set it up and get all of the shortcuts in the browser set up and just get all of your accounts in there. But once you use it, I think it's great. But I haven't tried many. Have you tried other ones, Russell? Have you tried Dashlane and LastPass?
I use LastPass, which is probably not. I mean, so it's the cloud version of 1Password. And it's probably just by virtue of being the cloud version, sort of less. You get fewer security points for doing it because it is kind of, if they ever had a problem, I would be really up a creek. I mean, and also I think it had to do with how they autofill, because I noticed that they changed it, but I think they recently got a bug report and changed what they were doing because there was some concern. Anyway, but I mean, from a usability perspective, yeah, it's been mm-hmm. perfectly easy to mm-hmm. use.
Mm-hmm. And for those of you, by the way, just very quickly, who have never used one of these password managers before, what it's doing is it's taking, let's say, your LinkedIn account, just because we used that example before, and you're saying, here's my email that I used to log in, and then it will generate a random password for you, and you use that to, you know, sign up for your account, and then that will store it for you, store that lengthy, multi-character, confusing, you're never going to remember password for you. And it just means that every time you go to log into those accounts now, you might have to go back and cross-check this password manager, copy and paste and put it in. So it makes the signing in process a little bit more of a pain. Totally worth it.
You can also have your own passwords too. You can also put your own passwords in there too.
You can, but they'll rank them for you. So like in 1Password, if it's not a very strong one, if it's weak, if it's likely to be, you know, it'll be yellow, I think, a yellow color will pop up. And then once you have a strong one, it'll turn green. And yeah, so anyway,
we recommend
you know, but they
them.
Do cost money.
We recommend
money.
Them. All right, the next one is from Eric Johnson, who works for us. Serious question for once. Yeah. For once? Okay. What is the lowest hassle way to do 2-factor authentication? Think of non-techie friends and family.
Yeah. So I actually have...
I've got my mom's in here. Mom, do you know 2-factor authentication? Obviously. Oh, she does. Okay, fine. Let's move along. All right, explain it for the regular people, not Lucky Carney.
Two-factor authentication is probably more important than having a password manager, and it is just, it means that if they have your password, they don't have everything, because it also is going to either there's an authentication code. Well, usually there's an authentication code, which you get either through an app a text. So the text is not great. Like, the text is probably the easiest one to get around, because they can just clone your phone if they hack into your AT&T account. Mm-hmm. I wrote a story a little while ago that was how they got through this guy's two-factor. I have this YubiKey USB thing, mm-hmm. which... it's like $20 for a USB key, which is a little steep, but it's not just storage. It's sort of doing some fancy handshake. And so I just put that into my computer's USB drive to log into my Gmail. Mm-hmm. And I am not the kind of person that loses their keys, but I respect that some people might. And so it'd be a pain for them. But if you are not the kind of person who loses your keys, I totally recommend it. I believe they have mobile versions, although I'm not sure entirely.
So you put it into your computer?
Yeah, I just put it into the computer, and then I push the little doohickey, and then...
And you have to have that particular device.
I need this particular device. And
what
also,
happens if it ends up in someone else's hands? Yeah. Your USB key?
They would have his computer and the device. And they would need to know how would they know what my Gmail account is, and also what my password is.
But then what if you lose that? What happens?
What if I lose it? Yeah. Well, then I'm really in trouble.
How do you get back in?
I mean, I would use one of the codes that Gmail gives you to... Well, no, but I mean, they give you the ones that you print out and put in your wallet. So I would have to use one of those.
You don't put them in your wallet.
Well, I guess that's better. This is a first world problem, but every time I switch hardware devices, like phone, I switch phones a lot because I'm testing them, and I have 2FA set up on one of them, then it's device specific. So it's still on that piece of hardware. And then I switch phones and I have to go through the whole process and set it up all over again. But I realize that's not a lot of people. A lot of people don't have that problem except for the very rare occasions when they switch phones.
No, but I mean, this is really the weakness in the system what you do if you're trying to break that then is you say, okay, well, I lost my key. I forgot my password. Like, come on, reset it for me. Yeah. And the question is, what's the standard then? I mean, this is how they got Matt Honan back in the day. They called up Apple customer service and they're a little more savvy on that one these days. Hopefully, yeah. I mean, but that
I tried the other day. They wouldn't give it to me. Not for anything. And
that's
for
good news. I mean, it was
not
probably
for
bad
all
the
hackers in China.
But yeah, I mean, that tends to be the weak point in the system. And at that point, it's really just leaning on companies to make sure.
You'd recommend two-factor authentication compared to not having it.
Oh, strong recommend. Do that in every...
Having a better lock on your door. Yeah. I mean, they're going to get in if they want to. But.
Well, and I would say also, especially for your phone service. So I'm on Verizon and I push for that because that's often how they try to get around it.
All right, Lauren, last question.
Last question is a long one. Daniel Smith, he's at Java Joint on Twitter, said we can use his name, though he did send me this in a private message. He said, greetings. I have a security question for your show.
Greets. He says greets.
Greets. I know. I'm going to start using that. It's quite nice.
That's a Brooklyn hello.
It's a. You would know. You've been spending a lot of time there.
I've just been,
exactly. You and the hipsters hanging out at the Apple store in Williamsburg. Going to Whole Foods and Warby Parker after this. Okay, it's considered good practice to use a VPN over open Wi-Fi, but what to do about places like cafes, airports, etc., that have captive portals? One can't start their VPN until they are connected, so for a short time they are exposed. Any ideas, like a pocket router gateway? This guy's like really getting granular. I kind of love it. Interested in what your guest will say. My own experience is that I prefer to tether my laptop to my phone via Bluetooth and then VPN from my laptop. So, taking a step back, first of all, what is a VPN? We've all used VPNs, explain briefly what a VPN is, and then this idea of captive portals in the brief interim he's talking about.
Okay, so...
Now, first start with captive portals, like open Wi-Fi that you have in an airport or...
Yeah, okay, so DEF CON and Black Hat, the hacker conferences are going on right now, and this is a common trick that they do where if you're connecting to an open Wi-Fi, that there's no sort of password handshake between you and the Wi-Fi, you don't know what it is you're connecting to. So someone else could have a fake Wi-Fi network that has the same name and they're sitting next to you. So you think you're connected to
the coffee shop,
mm-hmm. but really you're connected to Joe cyber criminal sitting next to you. Mm-hmm. And sort of, you don't even know when the switch took place because your computer just sees another network with the same name. He thinks it's just the same network with two routers.
Right. Is your computer a he? Mine's a she.
Yeah, I suppose I gendered it.
Or they.
Yeah, they.
My computer's a they.
So that's a very tricky, and this is also true, by the way, we're you know, just down the street from one of the new New York City public Wi-Fi terminals.
Which is called?
Link MIC. Owned by a Google, or operated, I should say, by a Google spinoff.
Yeah. Everything's operated by.
And so it's they have tokens that you can do for a more secure connection, but most people are going to be connecting in this open way, and there is this concern of, you know, is someone else going to make a fake Link MIC thing and then use that to spread a virus onto your computer, right? And so when he's talking about the brief interval there, the concern is that's, you know, the interval when you're signing on, right? Because if you're in a coffee shop Wi-Fi, a lot of times they'll flash a terms of service up front and ask you to click continue. And so is someone else going to masquerade as the Wi-Fi? And when you're clicking continue, really, you're getting a virus. So one of the things you can do is you can get a VPN, which means instead of connecting to the internet at large, you're connecting to this sort of third-party service, which you're then browsing the internet through that.
Right, which is supposed to protect you.
Yeah, and it's sort of because you have the password connection and or sort of HTTPS connection with that, you can be sure that everything you're talking to is really the thing that it says it is.
Do you go on open Wi-Fis?
I don't. I also, this is...
Never?
Is it like a hard, fast rule? It's going to make me lose my credit. I just stay on my phone.
You do it from your phone.
I do the
but
same.
But that's the thing. I just go on cellular data from my phone and resist the temptation to do more than email. And
okay,
I think
but what about
the,
if you have a laptop and you're somewhere, say you're a reporter for a fantastic tech publication?
No, but he's saying using the, he's using his phone as the hotspot. Right? Is that what you're saying?
The phone is the hotspot.
I mean,
or you just literally are on your phone.
I won't say that I've had 100%, you know.
But why wouldn't you use the phone as a hotspot?
Like,
why would you?
Well, no, I mean, I don't actually. I'm like on T-Mobile and I'm not even tetherable. It's
right.
It's like a weird. It's
all right.
A bad
situation, say you're on Verizon and you could be.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's.
Is that,
that
safer?
I think. Yeah. No, that I think is a solid, secure way of doing it. Mm-hmm. And I also think, I mean, in general, it is harder to compromise an iOS device.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's actually a fairly difficult thing just because software control is fairly serious. It's not just going to let you download and install a third-party program that doesn't come through the App Store. So unless it's got like an enterprise certificate or something, like it's going to be fairly hard to...
What about going through a MiFi that you'd plug into your computer?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I guess I'm thinking in terms of like threat levels and
okay,
things
we're
to,
the safest would be a MiFi or something like that. Right?
Well, the safest is not using
not
your
using.
Computer.
I got that
I'm
part,
but
that's
you
like
want
the
safest.
Is
an air gap.
You
like,
don't
want to
get a communicable disease. Don't have sex, and that's
the
usually
safest
not
is
the choice.
I can do lots of stuff on my phone.
Without Wi-Fi, you can do lots of stuff that's not sex.
I can use a modern media stack and
no,
publish
I get it,
to
but
the web
say you're
on
doing,
my
sometimes
phone,
you
so
have to be on your laptop. What is the list? Do the list.
I would say the MiFi is good. Tethering to your phone is good.
VPN,
you know,
right?
VPN through a, you know, if you're connecting, as soon as you do it, there's no portal. You're going directly to the VPN. That's good. And, you know, using
never an open cafe.
Wi-Fi.
I'm in a coffee shop.
Kara, remember when you went to China and you were looking for VPNs to download?
I was doing it.
We used one when we were in Vietnam last year, too. We had to use one through Hong Kong.
I just brought a crappy Android thing and
I mean,
threw
the thing
it out
they say if you're like, if you're like a Boeing executive and you're traveling to China and you know that you're going to be a target, they say just bring another laptop that's absolutely clean and has nothing. But,
I did that. Yeah. And then I had already signed into everything, so I didn't have to re-sign in. And then, so I didn't have to put my password in.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then I used that and threw it out.
There you go. Yeah, that's the move.
I assumed it was dirty, but I don't know. I mean, I had no idea if it was, but I don't care.
I mean, this is what now if we get... Sometimes to The Verge, we'll get an email where someone sends us a PDF and they say, you know, this is secret and yada, yada. Yeah. But we won't. And, you know, we have to open it. Like, what if it's the new iPhone or something or something even more newsworthy? And what we do is we get a Chromebook because, like iOS devices, you know, it limits what's available to run on it. And so the software controls on Chromebooks are generally better.
Mm-hmm.
And then we open it with a burner Gmail address. And... You know, even
so you
if it's,
send it to
we you, send it to yeah a separate test Gmail oh address God. That we have set up, and then we open it with a Chromebook, which has just been factory reset, and then
Neela
sets
it afire.
Well, no, then we send it. You know, send it back to factory reset it and send it back to Google when we're done with it.
Oh, you give it back to Kier Google.
Yeah, here you go.
Yeah, no,
dirty
exactly.
computer. Sorry.
Russell, do you recommend people use PGP for email or for anything?
PGP?
Yeah.
So
I mean, do you use it?
I mean, I have it. People can send email to me.
I do not understand it. I try it my hardest.
It's not.
It's so confusing. I know. All these geeks are going to write me, but it is. I'm sorry.
Well, no, it's funny. Actually, we were doing, we wrote this piece about Uber a little while ago that was getting, they were getting sued for this various thing. Well, no, it was for contracting this investigation that then turned out to commit fraud in the process of the investigation. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But the point is, they wanted to communicate secretly with the investigators, and they were going back and forth in PGP, and eventually the Uber executive said, look, I'm sorry, I can't open this email. Like, it's horrible. Just get Wicker and send it to me through Wicker.
Yeah.
And then we have the decrypted conversations up to that point. But once it was on Wicker, it self-deletes, and we don't have anything.
Oh,
so
wow.
They were able to be effectively secure.
Wow. That's interesting.
And we had Nico from Wicker.
She did.
At
I can't believe she even showed up. That she wore sunglasses on stage.
She actually wore sunglasses for longer than Kara did. Which
yes, and we also have. I just got from Mr. Robot the thing to cover up. This is my last question. Then we have to go.
Yeah.
I got from Mr. Robot a little cover up of the camera, which
yeah.
I use all the time. Before Mark Zuckerberg did, but all I cover up all the cameras.
Yeah.
I think that's a good idea. I mean, you know, it again, we haven't seen one of these on OS X yet, but like black shades, if you Google black shades, it was a very popular tool and remote camera access was a very popular part of it. And it cost like $40 to get this program that if you could get someone to click on the email, would then you would be able to take over their camera.
Yeah,
and it's also, it's an easy fix. It's a piece of tape.
You know what, like, I've what seen it in enough Hollywood problem? Shows and they're way behind, so I'm assuming it's...
No, it's a real thing. Yeah, I mean, the thing I like about it is it's a very easy fix and you
That's
just
how
do
I monitor Lauren
it's...
all the time. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, I was just going to say during this podcast, Kara, I actually, I hacked into your email because that's how easy it is. So I have a few that I want to read here, if you don't mind. So this one is from Ariana Huffington from over the weekend. She wrote to you. I just want to let you know. She wrote to you on Saturday morning and she said, "Dear Kara, while I usually enjoy your podcasts, especially that brilliant co-host of yours, I have to say that your impression of my accent is pitiful. Would you please stop trying to imitate me? I know sincerest form of flattery, but there can only be one me. Best, Ariana. P.S. Take Uber." Here's another one that actually came into your inbox last Friday that I saved for you. "Hey, Kara, can you call me when you get a sec? We need your advice. Verizon, having second thoughts. Tim."
They should have third thoughts. Very funny.
And then this last one is from you. I don't think you want people to know that you sent this one, but okay. "Hey, I heard you at another party on Saturday and once again did not invite me. Listen, I'm really hoping we can put the past behind us now. I wasn't hiding out in the air vents all those years, only sometimes. But really, Marissa, can't we be friends, please? Let me know the next time you're having a gathering. I make a mean trifle." So this is what's in Kara Swisher's inbox, everybody.
You know what? Those are good emails. But fascinatingly, everybody, all these people that you're discussing, text me. That's really fascinating.
Well,
Facebook
then
me.
I got into your iMessage.
We don't use emails anymore. And we use text and other ways of communicating. Sometimes we Snapchat each other. Ariana loves my way to talk about it. Have you heard my Ariana impression?
Oh, my God.
Oh, no. I'm very curious.
All right. Let me just do it for you, Russell. "This has been another great episode of Too Embarrassed Ask. Thank you to our special guest, Russell Brandon from The Verge." All right. Go ahead.
I just can't even follow that anymore.
Go ahead, baby.
Well,
come on,
if
babe.
You, thank you, Ariana. If you enjoyed the episode as much as we did and did not sleep through it, even though Ariana encourages everybody to sleep, be sure to subscribe to the show and leave us a review at itunes.com/too embarrassed to ask.
Let me just tell you, every time I write her 2 a.m, she responds to me and asks me why I'm not sleeping. And then I'm like, why the fuck aren't you sleeping? I'm just saying, I'm just going to just like tear the
debunking the
sheet
whole
off of that one, so
sleep
to speak.
Revolution.
And subscribing is great. You'll be the first to listen to new episodes every Friday or catch up on previous episodes where we answer all of the tech questions that our listeners have been too embarrassed to ask.
That's on itunes.com/too embarrassed to ask. You can also subscribe on Google Play Music, TuneIn or Stitcher, or you can listen to every episode at recode.net/podcasts.
And while you're there, you should check out our other podcasts like Recode Decode, Recode Replay, and Recode Media with Peter Kafka.
Yes. Kara, I listened to your Recode Decode with the Hamilton producer this morning on my way into work. It's fantastic.
Morning.
It's from a few weeks ago, so check it out, everybody.
I'm still not getting your tickets.
What was that?
I'm still not getting your tickets. Not happening.
Oh.
Sorry.
But you already had tickets.
I do.
Well, when you're mayor, you should take me to see Hamilton. Yeah. The Verge also has some great podcasts for your listening pleasure. Walt Mossberg and Neelay Patel have Control, Walt Delete. Neelay also hosts The Verge Cast. Chris Plant hosts What's Tech, and Liz Lopato and Emily Yoshida have Verge ESP.
And don't forget to tweet your questions ahead of time to @Recode with the hashtag TooEmbarrassed. Thanks for listening. Thanks again to our sponsors, Audible, Videoblocks, and Qualcomm. Thanks also to Digital Media, which distributes this show. Thanks to Russell for being here and tolerating us.
Yes, thank you.
We'll be back next week, where I will be broadcasting from down under in Australia to answer more of the questions that you have been too embarrassed to ask. Tune in then.